Hello, I am Sebastian Teotrillo.
And I'm Alex Hollingsworth.
Welcome to The Hidden Curriculum,
a podcast where we talk about all the stuff you didn't learn in graduate school. Hey, everybody. Hope you've had a great week. Sebastian, what is your least favorite Halloween candy?
I'm not really a fan of the Smartie. I think it's called Smarties. It's kind of like this like ripe, like pill type of candy. A lot of people seem to really like it. I think they're okay.
Compacted sugar, really.
Yeah. Okay. I must admit, this is like a Hidden Curriculum exclusive. I'm not a very sweet guy. So like, I'm very into savory. Like when I was celebrating Halloween as a kid, which I really did because in Peru, we do something else. I like wanted a little empanada, maybe like a little savory spinach kind of copita.
Weird guy that gives out like cooked foods?
Next year, I will. Okay. I want to give like the meatballs. I want to like, I just want to
like
go
a Costco sample different. Person. Like,
yes, exactly. That's my dream. Because when I was a kid, I was like, I don't need another Snickers, but a little spinach copita would go really well. You know, like, yeah. What about you, Alex?
It's easy. Candy corn. It's terrible. It's like the mosquito. If it was deleted from existence, everyone would be happier. I don't know who likes candy corn. Sarah, what about yourself?
I like Smarties and candy corn. I don't know what's wrong with you people.
Preferences are heterogeneous, ladies and gentlemen.
Gustibus non disputandum est.
It's important to mention Double Bubble, which is for sure the worst Halloween candy.
Which one is that one?
It's like a pink hard ball of gum. It's disgusting.
Is that the one they sell at the malls too? That like goes around.
It's like yellow with like blue. It kind of looks like it was all made in 1950s and that they have made too much and they're just still selling it from 1950.
Exactly. Oh, that's hilarious.
Gradually hardening.
I don't think I know that one very well. So I may have to look for it and try it.
Special guest today is Sarah Hammersma. Sarah is an associate professor of public administration and international affairs and a senior researcher associate in the Center for Policy Research. I think we left out the university on your intro at Syracuse University. Most of her research focuses on health and nutrition programs, examining their consequences for food insecurity, health outcomes, and labor supply. Sarah received her PhD in economics from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 2004. I promise that was not an intentional leave out, even though we're in like a fake rivalry between Syracuse and Indiana's MPA programs.
What do you mean fake?
It's you know, like who's one, who's two in the rankings. But thank you for being here. How are you doing?
Well, in hopes of encouraging transparency, I'm just gonna be honest with you. I am having a hard time keeping up this semester. There are a lot of good things going on. I enjoy the things I do, but there's not enough time to do all the things.
I believe that you will not be alone in that feeling. Appreciate you being transparent because you know sometimes things are not doing so hot.
Yeah, it's no 4 a.m. yoga over here either right now. This is definitely the like, oh my gosh, putting out fires time of the semester.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we always ask our guests to share a fun fact about themselves with the audience. Is there any fun fact that you care to share?
I really, really love singing 80s and 90s karaoke.
Oh, nice.
All about the power ballads. And as long as the vocal range is somewhere between Steve Perry from Journey and Whitney Houston, I'm on it.
Now, what is your most recent successful power ballad or song?
I really love Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That's my favorite go-to.
Do you start with one particular one to kind of like warm up?
I want to dance with somebody.
Of course, yeah.
Excellent one to get the crowd happy. Because I really love these power ballads, but sometimes they're slow and sad. And those are just not always like crowd pleasers, even though I love singing them. So,
you know, you're not the first guest that has said that they like karaoke. I'm thinking there may be market here. I'm sorry.
Trang Hong?
Yeah. I think we should at the next in-person AAAs get a little karaoke thing going on.
So they actually did this years ago.
I missed it.
Yeah. So you have a very good idea. And in fact, it was so many people that it was like a little overwhelming for a person like me, but we had to rent out a whole bar because there were probably 60 or more people there.
How are economists on karaoke?
I couldn't really hear them. Like, that's
so excellent.
I felt like I was at a club. I felt very old. I think it was something that was more hip with the younger economists. And I usually don't think of myself as one of the older economists, but I think I'm beginning to cross into that territory.
So you're saying you didn't see Daniel McFadden up there singing anything?
No, I was really relieved when I saw like one of my economist friends who's older than me there. It's like, oh, you're here. Yay.
I remember when people were like talking about this karaoke and I was like, dang, I love karaoke. So I was like, I'm going to miss it. And I was like, okay, I want to do a karaoke thing. I also want to see like a rap battle between economists because that would be hilarious in many different ways. So yeah, there's a lot of things we need to organize for that very specific econ crowd.
Just start figuring out what rhymes with identification and you'll be fine.
Asian, there's a ton of those.
All right. So before we dive into today's topic, we'd love to hear about a paper or some project that you're working on that you'd like to promote. Is there anything of that nature?
As we'll get into with today's topic, I really like writing. I love words. I love thinking about communicating, especially across disciplinary boundaries. And so some of the work that I've really enjoyed in the last few years takes my research expertise and actually applies it to more reflective essays that are written to a non-economist audience. I have a few pieces in a public theology magazine called Comment that have really been a unique challenge and have been really satisfying. So one's about food insecurity on college campuses. So it draws on the research I've been doing on that and tries to pull in some of the higher ed research as well on sort of what students are looking for in colleges and how colleges spend their money. That's called Are We Our Students' Keeper? So it gets at this sort of philosophical question of who's responsible for making sure college students are fed. But my favorite thing I've written that I would love some of your listeners to read if they're interested is something called Uncertainty, the Beauty and Bedrock of Statistics. And it's basically an ode to statistics. I would love for people to give me their thoughts on it. And it's trying to lay out the utility of statistics to people who are probably not prone to want to use statistics. And also the sort of aesthetic glory of statistics and what they accomplish. And I had a lot of fun writing it.
I love this. Is this for you like a creative outlet or this is like mini work or what is it?
I think it's mostly a creative outlet. I haven't been discouraged from doing it because I do think I'm able to connect it with my research and teaching in a way, but it's certainly not sort of like on the main research palette. It's off to the side and it's, I would say like, it tends to be a smaller audience, but to me, like a really unique audience that's good to communicate with, which is like humanities people. And so I encouraged my students, for instance, I was teaching statistics. And when the piece came out, I said, like, I don't know if you'll like it or not. Like it's got a theological piece to it as well. And so it's like, it's a little bit weird and interesting, I think. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of realized like, take with it what you will. Like, but I think it's an example of me using some of my teaching to try to explain mm-hmm. how statistics works and specifically like sort of what is it good at and what mm-hmm. do people use it for that it's not good at mm-hmm. and it gets a bad reputation because people are doing it wrong. So it's sort of trying to like refurbish the image of statistics as like this really, really cool thing.
That's awesome. I also teach a similar type of student that you do, and I teach the intro stats class, and I have them read right now the introductory chapter of statistical rethinking, where it talks about like the Gollum of Prague and all these like ways that people are like misusing statistics. This is just from skimming it, a way, way better version and more accessible than anything that I have them doing now. I still like that reading that I have them do, but I'm going to assign this in my class. This looks awesome.
Wow. Thanks. I had the very good fortune of getting to write it right before the big election. And so I used like Biden, if there's a poll and Biden gets this much in the poll, like what can you infer about the population? So it was kind of a nice time to where everybody was seeing statistics and COVID statistics. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of in that joint context of 2020. Mm-hmm. Ode to statistics in 2020 has a unique flavor to it.
I love this. I didn't know. I just Googled it. And I think if people want to find it, the best way is to Google the name of the article. Is that correct?
Yeah,
we'll put absolutely. A link in the show.
We'll put a link to the show note. It looks really cool. It also reinforces now this idea that I had of you, which is you enjoy writing. And like, this makes sense because like this a person who enjoys writing would do this as well. So like that is super interesting. Now I want you to have a newsletter where you write to us every 2 weeks, maybe. I don't know.
You're not the first person to ask me to do that. I definitely don't have time to do that. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, that's fair.
But what I'm trying to do is kind of embrace my love of writing. And so, as you know, Sebastian, you know, now when I look for new co-authors, I tell them like I'll be like the main writing person if you will be the main other stuff person. Mm-hmm.
You're going to get a lot of emails.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. I've had like the sort of you had me at hello kind of conversation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Sarah and I vibe real well because I'm a coder.
I just love writing the story. I love like figuring out how to construct Perfect. The argument. And yeah, I love
That's it. Great. I appreciate that your existence so much here. I just love reshaping and like,
yeah, me too. You know, like,
exactly. I have to look up how to do reshape every blessed time. Like there was this one time where I did reshape right the first time. And I remember posting to Facebook. Yeah. I was so excited.
People go nuts for the reshape command. There's like, it's basically like a meme now. And I still like, I feel like people don't know about the at symbol. The at symbol and reshape makes your life better. So maybe
I don't know about the at symbol. Put it as a rec of the week.
I'll save it for my tip.
Yeah, right, there you go.
All right. So that now that we're starting to talk about work, maybe we could hear a little bit about your workflow, about what your day-to-day is like. You're an associate professor. You do lots of stuff. We'd love to hear just about how you get it all done.
Well, I wish I had a really cool answer to this question. I super enjoyed listening to David Slusky describe this on this podcast. And I mean, it just sounded brilliant. I was really fascinated with this idea. But I cannot sugarcoat it in my own case. So fundamental to my workflow is that I make plans and I don't follow them and it's inefficient. That's how it goes.
Step number one.
Yeah, exactly.
I generally use my Google Calendar for everything, including trying to schedule blocks for research. Like this is when I'm going to work on this. This is when I'm going to work on that. And then like the time gets taken away from me somehow. Mm-hmm. It's just an endless source of just figuring it out. So I became PhD director here about a year and a half ago, and I really love that. Awesome. It is absolutely the right. That's the other thing about David's podcast was sort of like figuring out your service.
Yeah.
I am in my sweet spot. I love it. But the email volume associated with being a PhD director was just, and like weird one-off responsibilities just that come right. up. They creep in everywhere. And so I think I'm also still in recovery mode because I have two kids. They're in sixth and eighth grade now, and they were home from school from March 2020 until June 2021.
Just a minor time commitment.
Yeah. So both my kids qualify for IEPs, specifically like the presence of a teaching assistant. That would be like not a one-on-one, but floating, you know, in the room to help them stay focused and stuff. And so my husband and I were the teaching assistant. We were at home.
Wow.
One of us was always there. Frequently while we were there, we were with one of the kids just trying to make sure things were staying on track. They're back at school. We're trying to find the new normal. I'm trying to figure out how to work during the day and not during the night. But I haven't found it yet because there was just a time when working at night was just my regular work time. Like it wasn't inappropriate. It just was when I could work.
What do you think is the thing that you took time away from when you started being more present there for the kids because they were staying at home? Like what was the thing that you were not doing or the change that happened to your work life there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was talking to some other faculty and they were saying like, they felt like they were just bad at everything for a long time. And I actually... I graded myself. I can't remember why, but
wow, so harsh.
I graded myself and I said, here's what I'm doing. For my kids, I'm getting an A. I'm like doing exactly what they need me to do right now. They're my first responsibility. They're my own kids, right? Mm-hmm. I get an A for kids. I get a B for students. I'm doing okay with the students. I was kind of keeping up and that was pretty good. And then the C and the D are all everything else.
Yeah.
So research,
right.
Other forms of service. I've been a co-editor at JPAM for 3.5 years. So I was still doing that, but on a much slower timetable. I was on a research grant. I continue to be on, but it gradually got behind partly because of some staffing issues with the actual grant. One of my collaborators retired unexpectedly, but the research really got behind. And what I found is even though I can now be feeling like I'm back to doing my whole job every day, the backlog is just still there. I would say like my workflow is full-time working mom with two kids with disabilities, and it's scrappy and creative, and it's a kind of give it all you got and enjoy each piece as it comes. I really, really love my job. I don't actually have enough time to do all the pieces that I wish I could do. And so one of the things I've done, for instance, is start a new project with a couple of co-authors not naming any names, Sebastian. but because I think it really helps me to have like that there's not something that's only on my plate, because the things that are only on my plate get shafted. Mm-hmm. It has to be something where there's a built-in like collaboration and a check-in right. process. Mm-hmm. And that's true. Even when I have just one collaborator, if they're a good friend, I've found that we're not able to push each other the way that we need to, because we're just, you know, we know that we're both like that this is the last thing on the list for both of us. Mm-hmm. And so it's just really hard to get anywhere. Mm-hmm. So I love having like new collaborators, weekly meetings, like even if there's a, you know, the weeks now and then where it's like, sorry guys, I didn't get anything done, but there's at least that like momentum of the project is an ongoing thing that is happening.
That's really interesting. And thank you for sharing with us your kind of like struggle. I actually really liked, and I appreciated you talking about like, you know, how in tough times we have to prioritize. And you should feel good that on the things that are the top priority, you're doing well. There are things in our life that may be more important than some parts of the work. And so like, we should give ourselves some slack for not doing so good at those things, but that makes sense.
Yeah. It's a good reminder too, of like, I like that you said that how much you liked your job. I know like a big part of Twitter is like people venting and stuff. Like it's like an outlet all through COVID and everything. I just kept thinking like, yeah, like I'm temporally shifting things. Like, boy, am I lucky to be able to be doing this. Like, I can have my awesome job. And like, I just recorded a class at 11 PM tonight. Like that sucked. Mm. But like the fact that I could do that and keep my job was actually pretty awesome. Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that aspect as well.
So let me circle back to your workflow. So let me ask you a couple of questions to understand it. Do you like work Monday to Friday or Monday to Monday?
I mostly work Monday to Saturday.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that I never work on Sunday, but I sort of try not to. Mm-hmm. I'm a practicing Protestant Christian. I think Sabbath is important. I think actually we all know now that it is.
Yeah.
It's sort of one of those things that's like come back around is like, oh, people need time to recharge. And so I try to usually take Sunday off. And if I can not work a whole day on Saturday, it's mostly Monday through Friday, the day. And then there will be like, bring a kid to a therapy appointment, or my parents live in town too. So like, maybe there'll be something that they need, and like I had to bring the car to the shop yesterday after the kids go to bed. Then it's like, okay, what else has to get done tonight? Mm. And really the organizational piece of it is trying to set myself up so that the things that are left to do at night are things that I feel like I can do when my brain is kind of fried. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I found like a lot of the administration and emails for the PhD program and emails with students in the PhD program, I'm like perfectly able to do those kinds of things at night, but I'm not really able to like take on a research project. Even if I have like a couple hours, I just can't like dive into that at 9:30 at night.
That makes sense. And then, so that means that you're kind of like working throughout the day / with family duties and work at the same time.
Yeah. It's like all the benefits of the job. Like Alex is describing, like there's a lot of benefits of the flexibility of the job, but that means you sort of, people are like, why are you sending emails at this time? Well, it's because like I didn't work from, you know, 2 to 5 that day. You know, it's not that this isn't a thing where I'm like spending 15 hours a day at work. Mm-hmm. Not at all. It's just that the work is very integrated with the life. And so it's a certain kind of lifestyle, you know, and I've been talking with PhD students about that, those who are thinking about whether to be academics or not, what they like and don't like about it. And trying to be honest, like it's a certain kind of lifestyle. The work is always there, it's always hanging over your head. You have to be able to live with that and be able to set things down even when they're not done yet and be ready for the academic calendar.
I really like both those comments. I know we're like diverting a little bit from workflow, but like the idea that it's a certain kind of lifestyle. I've like thought of this analogy before, like that it's like you run a small business where like you're in charge of everything and like the success or failure of the business. Cause it's just like, you know, I really envy in some aspects of people where they go home and like, they don't think about work after 5 PM. Like I'm like constantly thinking about work. You know, I don't know. I like that you bring that up and you share that with students.
Yeah. And it's interesting that analogy, because as people grow in their careers, right, they're taking more responsibility. Some people even develop like centers in which they manage RAs and staff and so on. And so like, it seems that it is, there's some entrepreneurship about this job. Today, we want to talk about something that you may have never heard before, or at least I didn't until Sarah was talking about it, and that's called statistical grammar. So let's get right into it. Sarah, what is a statistical grammar, and where does that term come from?
Well, I love that you asked me where it came from, because I just made it up, Sebastian.
I was wondering if you made it up.
I did. I made it up, and I'm really hoping it catches on. So this is my pitch for the day, but it's sort of my little contribution to the world. So it's not necessarily an original idea. It's pulling some ideas together, and it's inspired partly by Steve Ziliak and Deirdre McCloskey's work on errors in statistical interpretation in the AER. So the thing I call statistical grammar is the set of rules that anyone interpreting a statistical analysis ought to apply when they're writing about the analysis. So this is about writing. It's not about estimation. That's the most important piece. Mm-hmm. So it's built on the idea that statistical analysis can be easily misinterpreted. And in fact, there are strong incentives to misinterpret it.
And we've seen that in the past few years, how that's very much the case.
Absolutely. And it's our job to provide clarity and accuracy. And in fact, to make it impossible to misunderstand what we're saying. Not just to communicate it in a way that could be correctly understood, but that could not be misunderstood. And the foundation of statistical grammar, as I've conceived of it, is really about remembering there's a difference between the parameter of interest, the actual beta that we don't and will never know, the effect of X on Y, and the estimates of those parameters, and how we talk about estimates and don't mix them up with the population parameter that we're estimating.
Which I'm sure I've done before.
So everybody does it.
Can I ask you a little bit of like, how do you develop this idea and this framework? So was it like throughout your grad school as a professor? Like, how does this come about?
I remember even in grad school finding something in a piece we read for class where I thought, wow, the text of this paper does not match what I'm seeing in this table. It was a piece where the authors were arguing that you needed to add another particular covariate to the model, and they added the new covariate. And the new covariate, the coefficient was not statistically significant on the new covariate. And the coefficient of interest had barely changed. And so when I looked at that, I said, doesn't seem like that was a terribly important addition. It doesn't change anything about the inference. And that variable itself doesn't seem to, you know, suggest a strong connection with the outcome. Doesn't seem like we've solved an omitted variables bias problem, because there didn't seem to be any bias. The coefficient of interest hasn't really changed. And in the paper, what I saw written up was authors who were so committed to the theoretical reason for adding that coefficient or that variable that they just had to interpret it as if they had found something really important there. And I think I immediately saw this tension when we have something that we're planning to say and hoping to say, and the contribution we want to make, when the regression just doesn't really bear that out, we still have this tendency to sort of read it through the glasses that we always had in mind.
Is that analogous, or maybe not, to like trying to be like indifferent if there's parallel trends and sometimes the regression doesn't give us that? Or maybe that's a little bit different.
There's this squint and the trends look parallel enough, right? Like there's sort of, we know what we're looking for. Right. And so we hope to see it, and we're more likely to see the thing we're hoping to see. I did a paper once, and Jim Ziliak was really helpful in pointing this out to me afterwards after I presented it. It was a paper about bunching. I was trying to see if people's labor supply bunched under Medicaid thresholds to keep them eligible for Medicaid, because Medicaid is kind of the last program that has no phase out. Like you just, one day you make too much money and it's just taken away from you. And so the incentives are really strong. And so I did these bunching things and these histograms, and you know, if you looked at the histogram, you could say, yeah, maybe there's a little bunching there. You could also look at it and there's not a lot of evidence of bunching. And of course, then I ran some regressions and stuff. But what Jim said was the challenge of writing this paper up is everyone's going to see what they expect to see. Because it's not clearly one way or the other. And so people who don't really think welfare recipients respond to these kinds of things are going to say, yeah, there's no bunching there. And people who do think like that, well, the theory really predicts the bunching and we should see it, they're going to kind of see it there. And so it creates a really interesting sort of dilemma as to how you write up results.
So what are some of these rules that people can follow beyond making it impossible to misunderstand? And then I have questions afterwards about what does that mean when we start to make our own choices about, like, what should we make clear and not clear?
There's some like matters of preference, but the things that I think of as the rules are things that I think we should theoretically all agree on. And the foundation of it is that any adjective, this is why I call it grammar, any adjective that applies to statistics should only be applied to statistics, meaning you cannot have a statistically significant effect of X on Y, because there is an effect of X on Y, but you don't know what that effect is. You have an estimate of it. Mm. So the phrase statistically significant effect gets used a lot as if that statistically significant somehow modifies.
I see the effect, which in reality is it an effect on itself, like a true effect.
Yeah. Derek Neal taught me back in labor economics, and he actually taught us this as PhD students. In so doing was saying, this is how I teach my undergrads econometrics, and this is how I now teach my MPAs econometrics. An estimator, beta hat, an estimator is a random variable. It has a distribution. Beta has no distribution. Beta has no statistical properties at all. Beta is a number that we don't know. Mm-hmm. One could say this, maybe this is just semantics, but I think it really ends up affecting how people understand the results that we have. Sort of rule number one is statistically significant can only modify an estimate, not an effect. You could say statistically significant coefficient if you want. Could say statistically significant estimate or even estimated effect if you want to sort of push the envelope a little, but only use statistical language to modify statistical objects.
So, okay. So let me practice. So is this right? If I write, we estimate a statistical significant effect, or is that, you think, not great? Because I'm still saying that.
Really? You're getting there. You're pushing that bubble.
I am trying to push the bubble.
You know, I think it's a spectrum of like, So the at the top of my statistical grammar, like two pager that I've made, my subtitle is interpreting regression coefficients without accidentally lying and spouting nonsense. So I don't think you're lying or spouting nonsense when you say that.
Right.
I think what you want to know is, does the reader think that you know what the effect is? Or does the reader understand that you have a range of estimates that you think are likely to contain?
Right. I could make it clear in that way. So maybe the sentence that I pick could or could not be, but that's not the point. The point is to make it clear. And so maybe there's a different way to say it that is much more clear to get to that point.
Well, one of the things that tends to be an issue is it tends to take longer to say it correctly.
Yeah.
So one of my other rules is the word significant is already a word in English. The word significant means important, momentous, compelling, of consequence. Significant has a meaning. And so if you are using it without the modifier statistically, you are potentially confusing things.
Right. Because some people may be like, oh, it's important rather than the statistical part.
And I think some of this is like sort of subliminal, right? Mm-hmm. Like somehow, I mean, the word has that meaning and you can say, well, in our context, we're talking about it in the statistical sense. But the problem is statistical significance is a measure of precision. It's a totally different object. Mm-hmm. It is not really related at all to importance.
On this same note, I remember the first time when I was in grad school going to a conference and I saw a bunch of people present insignificant result, without stars, as imprecise. I was like, ooh, what a way to like frame it. And then the more I started to think about it, the more I was like, actually, like that like is probably the right way to phrase it, you know, because like if you were to look at like a p-value, they had like a p-value of like 0.2 there. Like, is that not meaningful? Like, you know, just kind of imprecise relative to some threshold. I like this language a lot because it can help present things in a clearer way too.
Yeah. And I think this really lends itself to p-values and confidence intervals as ways to think about precision rather than hypothesis testing. That's like the yes, no test. Mm-hmm. And what really made me start writing these things down a few years ago was I was teaching a sort of a remedial review session for my students who weren't understanding hypothesis testing. It just wasn't like clicking. And I sat down with them. Well, I guess I was probably standing at a board. And I said, you've been taught that you do a hypothesis test. You see if it's statistically significant or not. And then if it's statistically significant, then you talk more about it. That's the, the heuristic that we teach, that I was teaching. Mm-hmm. First, this test, if it's not statistically significant, you really can't say much more.
Right.
If it is, then you can maybe talk more about it. But what it turned out, what I realized really painfully was I was teaching them that the hypothesis was really checking if it estimate was right. That's what they were hearing. Like, is the estimate nothing? If it's insignificant, they're taking that to mean nothing, which isn't true necessarily at all. But then if it was, by telling them like, okay, now talk about the coefficient, it was almost like, we're testing to see if this is the right number. Instead, I said, what we're doing is we're actually just checking the sign. That's the only thing the hypothesis test does. Mm-hmm. It's only checking a sign. It isn't really giving you anything more than that. And the students' minds were really blown. Because all along they thought it was doing something more.
Right.
And I feel like we write as if it's doing something.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that that's illustrative to students, but even as a PhD student, this was like kind of unclear to me. The idea that a point estimate and a confidence interval are not the same thing is very obvious to me now. And I don't think that was as obvious to me in any way when I first started reading applied micro papers. Like, oh, the treatment effect is 11%. You're like, actually, it's probably positive.
Right.
It's like a very different like thing.
Exactly.
So we talked about this statistical significant part and the adjective that applies to statistics. Let's walk through another kind of like rule so people understand this examples of statistical grammar.
I think the flip side of how we mistakenly interpret statistically significant estimates as if we now know the effect. The flip side of that is sometimes I read papers that say they found statistically insignificant effects. Yeah, that breaks like the this. First rule, of course. But that's not even the most important thing. When you say that, people think you mean there's no effect and you don't know that. And this is where I think the confidence intervals are even more important, because you can find something to be statistically insignificant because your sample size is really small. You have really minimal variation in a particular facet of your sample. You have no power. I've seen papers where the estimated coefficient is the same as the other one they talked about, but the standard error is bigger. And my goodness, people act like the effect, quote, went away.
By zero, right.
Nothing happened to it.
So the way I've also conceptualized that of how to, quote unquote, deal with that is to talk about what at least I call statistical significance, but also economically significance, which is this idea of like how big that coefficient is. Is that a way to mitigate that, or you want to keep those thoughts separated because there's an issue about precision and there's an issue about size of the effect?
It's very, very connected.
Okay.
And I think of it as sort of the supplement, like it's not instead, but it's along with statistical significance. And this is where I think I go a little bit off from Ziliak and McCloskey, who I think really want us to get entirely away from the idea of statistical significance as a useful idea. Okay. I maintain that it's useful. One great thing about Ziliak and McCloskey. So McCloskey is also a professor of rhetoric and history. She's a Renaissance person, and she just has like, she has a sort of fingers in all kinds of pots, and her writing is just great. It's just really fun reading. I give it to my students in the PhD methods class the first day. And it's just a really fun way to start off the semester because it's sort of like there's good wordplay and it's kind of angry. And there's a lot of personality in the writing that I think we lack in a lot of the writing that we read. But I sort of go off track from them in that I think statistical testing is really, really important still. But the use of the sort of yes, no hypothesis test is what gets us in trouble, not the p-values. If we can just understand p-values, we're in just much better shape. And this issue of economic significance is one of their big points. They call it oomph. You need to know if your estimates have oomph. I had a classmate in grad school who estimated a statistically significant effect of some kind of windfall of money on retirement age. It was making people retire like 2 days earlier. And you kind of go, I mean, that's a finding, but it's also, it's not much.
Right.
I saw a birth weight paper where they're looking at state EITC and birth weight. They got the state EITCs to bump up birth weights by 15 grams. Average kid is 3,200 grams. Kind of go, okay, like it's amazing that you could get to that precision. It's really cool. And when it's such a like second, third, fourth order effect of a really effective program, it's okay. But I think sometimes we really are looking for the stars instead of looking for the action.
Like, right.
How much
I think the way I see it a lot is sometimes when I referee papers and they're trying to run a reg where you're not supposed to find an effect here and they run it and it's not a statistically significant, fair enough, but it's also a smaller sample, but the effect is huge on its own. And I always feel weird because as a referee, I'm like, I don't know if I'm misinterpreting things, but this seems like a quite big effect that is just imprecisely estimated. So I would want it a zero rather than I rather have a zero that is statistically significant than right, like quote unquote zero size, than to tell me that you don't think there is something big enough here. But yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if this is one of your rules, but a thing that I have learned in the past little bit, which I didn't also ever really learn in grad school, is just because your estimate is statistically different than zero in your sample does not mean that the true effect is there or that you're well-powered. So I see this all the time in seminars. It drives me nuts. Mm. People are like, I didn't expect to have power to find stars here, but I found it. So that must mean we're well-powered. And Gelman and Carlin have this fantastic paper that just says, if you've got low power and you happen to find a statistically significant, something that's not, you know, the same as zero in your sample, you're going to likely have a multiple of the effect of the true treatment effect. And you might even have the wrong sign because you're only going to be drawing from the tail of the null distribution.
I didn't know that until I read Alex's paper, and that blew my mind.
Our paper is sort of just like a simulation based on Gelman and Carlin's paper, right? Like it's really like this Gelman Carlin paper is really good. So
that sounds amazing. I have on my list for today to mention Gelman and Stern, which is a paper with this amazing title. The difference between significant and not significant is not itself statistically significant.
That's awesome.
So wow. Wonderful. Wow. They show how easy it is for people to say, oh, like I ran this for the men and the women and I get, you know, it's significant for the men, but not for the women. It's like, yeah, but that's because there's not that many women in the sample. You look at the actual numbers, you do the statistical test.
Mm-hmm. We might be nerding out too hard now for as people who teach introductory stats classes, but in my introductory stats class, I have them read the Scientific American article called Race in a Bottle, which is about a drug that was basically approved. It has a race specific designation. And it seems like they basically did an analysis like that, where it's like not super obvious that like it should work better for one race versus another, but it happened to be in the subsample that was statistically different from zero of a treatment effect. And like, it's actually kind of one of these weird things. Like, I think that the drug works. It's like, it's good that it's out there and not out. That's like, it's hard for me to think about like, what is like a better outcome for public health, but for statistics literacy, it's not my favorite thing.
So let's say people are interested in correcting themselves more and learning more about this. Is there a place they can go so they can see some of these rules?
You know, I think I'm looking for the right outlet to publish these rules. I don't quite know what it might be. And
maybe like a song, like Dua Lipa, like seven rules, you know, one, don't pick up.
I have a parody. I have two parodies. I have a parody of Adele, Hello, and Someone Like You. And they're written to my econometrics students. So I'll have to sing those for you sometime.
You must be such a cool professor.
I was inspired. I got a teaching award from my students and they had this banquet thing. So I needed to go the next day and I was about to fall asleep. And suddenly I was like, wait, hello, but it's about me waiting in my office for them to come to office hours.
That is hilarious.
That's awesome.
You don't even hardly have to change the words because it's like hello.
Right. Yeah.
It's just like you.
And it even has the line to go over everything.
Okay. So you thought about publishing some of these things in a particular outlet, but have you already given a talk then in different places about this?
No, I haven't. I've sort of one thing that I've done, and this is actually one of the first times we connected, Sebastian. I don't think the first time, but whenever I give discussant comments at a conference, whoever the victim is of my discussant comments,
recipient,
I'm a nice discussant.
Happy recipient.
Happy recipient. I'm a nice and helpful discussant. I realized that every single person makes mistakes on these things. And so I started calling it the Sarah Hammersmith slide. Like that's the title of the slide in the middle of my discussant comments. I was like, now this is my slide. It's not you, it's me, but I can't not say this.
Right.
Like you said something, increases, but you don't have a dynamic model. So you need to say when it's higher or lower, not increases and decreases. Like, so that's another like grammatical thing, right? Like, what can you actually say? Like, you don't have evidence that increasing X will change Y because you don't have that in your data unless you're using longitudinal data. Mm-hmm. You just know that higher X has higher Y.
Right.
But I'll go through and say, you said you found, this I don't think I've mentioned yet, attaching the sign to the insignificant effect. So I got a negative but insignificant estimate. Okay.
I've definitely written that. So I want to hear it. Sign,
right? The word negative means you know the sign, and the word statistically insignificant means you don't know the sign. So you can't say negative statistically insignificant estimate. It's like you have to be more careful.
Like students are very good at coming up with ways of submitting a 10-page paper when they only wrote 4 pages worth of work. I feel like once I hear the words, I'm like, oh, I came up with like a way of skirting your rule, but that's like not in the spirit of it. Like I have like a 68% confidence interval that like is negative or some like weirdo idiosyncratic amount.
Sometime I wrote something and I said that, you know, we would only have 85% confidence or something. And the referees are like, what is this 85%? You know, it was just like,
I like it though, right? Because it's more like illustrative of like what we're doing.
It's a spectrum. And like, honestly, as long as P is less than 0.5, it's more likely than not that your sign is right. And it just gets better from there. So it's just, we have in some ways some like sort of weirdly high standards for being willing to talk about things, but then also like these weird low standards about sort of saying like, oh, I don't find anything because it's insignificant.
This is not meant to be antagonistic, but I'm just like legitimately curious. So I hear an argument a lot. We need to be careful when we're communicating research to other researchers, but there's a different audience sometimes for our output, like policymakers or politicians. Do you worry at all that sometimes being so hyper precise in the language might confuse or enable people to sort of run with a result that's not statistically different from zero and claim that there's like no effect of some policy? And if so, like, are there ways we can guard against that when we're like, are there ways we can write to both audiences in the same document, or do we need to do other things to try to protect against misinterpretation of our statistically correct language?
I think we probably need two versions. I'm not sure you can write something that works for everybody. One of the things that I think we should try to do as a profession is normalize the use of ranges and confidence intervals, even when we're talking publicly, when people would like a point estimate, a talking point, to simply not provide things that way. To say, it looks like this job training program likely increases employment by 2 to 6%. And just don't give them that number to run with, or to say, it might not do much, but it could be up to 5%. That's what we found. The incentives, both within publication and in the public sort of sphere, are to be more certain than you really are. And so I think we have to, it's not as much just like being accurate, but it's sort of like, we are gonna be constantly in tension with what is being asked of us. And this is part of what my uncertainty essay is about, is this idea that there's an expectation that statistics provide certainty about things that are uncertain.
There is one thing that I saw, and I like it as an innovation, and I think goes along with this question, which is that, the first time I saw this is Annalisa Hackham doing this, which is you write your paper, your working paper, whatever, and in the end, you have like a frequently asked questions about the paper. And it's essentially right, a fact of like, how do you know this is a causal effect, or what do you need to assume? And I think within that, I almost kind of start wondering if I should write all my papers with a frequently asked questions where I answer all these things, and including talking about how to interpret the estimations for a broad audience. And that's the place where a lay or a non-academic audience can go and read about those stuff in addition to other questions that they may have. So when I saw that and Annalisa doing that, I was like, you know what? I kind of want to have this for all my papers, because it works even better, in my opinion, than like a policy brief, in that phrasing everything as a question, it's much more easier to consume than, hey, here's a 3-page policy brief.
Yeah.
I like that quite a bit. And I know it's not exactly the same thing, because you're talking about it, the structure is having questions, but I do also love Andrew Goodman Bacon's, so you've been told to do my diff and
yes.
Chang and Hoekstra have a 4-page piece that they wrote when they did a paper on gun laws thing, because they needed to explain to the journalists what the premise was. And so they basically explained diff and diff with 2 states and, you know, 1 policy change. And they sort of laid out like, this is fundamentally the kind of comparisons we're making. And then they sort of build it a little bit from there. And it's really nice too. It serves double duty because I assign it to master's students. I assign that paper, but then I say, there's this 4-page thing that can really help you like get a grasp on it if you're not feeling like you follow it.
So I think it's really convincing that we have these issues as a profession and probably across like any profession that uses numbers in general. Why is it that you think these problems exist? And when people point out issues that people are not correcting and sort of taking these structural issues with how they write about statistics into account.
I speculate that there are a few things driving this. So one is people are looking for meaningful results. When you have a research idea, you don't go into it saying, maybe there's nothing here. You go into it saying, hopefully there's something here. So I'm making a contribution. We're learning something new. And we tend to perceive learning something new as finding a statistically significant estimate. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's intentional or unintentional, we tend to push too hard on our estimates to cooperate with our sort of vision. And so that's one reason I think the rules don't get followed too well. For instance, people will say that, you know, I got the positive effect that I was expecting, but it's not statistically significant. You sort of say, well, that means you don't know it's positive. That's what the statistical test tells you. You just really want to say it still. So there's just this sort of like psychological and I think publishing pressure. It also takes a lot of care with words, and it requires more words almost always to do a careful job of this. And it takes some practice for those words to read smoothly. When I teach my students, I say, you know, technically this is a test of whether something is statistically significantly different from zero. Mm-hmm. And that's a very long phrase, and it gets reduced to statistically significant, and that gets reduced to significant. Mm. And you have to carry the whole meaning of that long phrase without losing what the test is. And I think we do lose what the test is. But I think most important is this happens in all of our journals. Our students read all the journal articles.
Right. Gets reinforced.
It's reinforced. And so it's very hard to unlearn.
So let's say we're interested, or a listener is interested in learning these rules, but has not had the privilege of having you discuss one of their papers at a conference. How is it that they can come across this list of rules so they can improve their writing?
Well, I've been sort of tweaking it over the last couple of years, but I will post this on my website because I would love to get more feedback from your listeners and to think more about whether there's a good platform for it as well.
Thank you so much for those insights. I really learned a lot, and I feel like I've been doing now things wrong from a long time, but I'll improve from now on. Every week, we'd like to ask our guests for a recommendation of the week. This can be anything, a podcast, a command, an app, a song, quote, a book, kitchen recipe, anything that improves your life in a small way. Sarah, what is your recommendation of the week?
So recently, I have been fangirling over my friend Tish Harrison Warren, who has gotten a Sunday column in the New York Times. And it's geared towards spiritual reflections. Her first piece is called Why We Need to Start Talking About God. And she is just incredibly insightful about the spiritual dimensions in American life.
Wow.
And I think social scientists should really pay attention when the New York Times has decided to have a columnist focus on this, because even if this stuff isn't of personal interest to them, certainly as a social scientist, I think it should make you want to understand more about why the public is hungry for these kinds of conversations. And Tish is an amazing writer.
And how do you know this person?
I had a chance to read a book of hers. She has two books now. The first one, I was able to interview her for the same magazine where I published those essays.
Oh, wow.
I'm a contributing editor. And so one of my suggestions for an issue was to interview her. And so I've only met her virtually, but we had a great conversation about sort of life, culture, Christianity, and sort of faithfulness. And she's worked on college campuses. She's an Anglican minister and writer. And so she's just a super interesting person and has a lot of insight about people.
Alex, what is your recommendation of the week?
All right. So I was told earlier in the show to do it on Reshape. So I know Reshape has become like a meme on Twitter where people are like, I got it to work, or it never works, or it's slow or whatever. This is like the nerdiest comment ever, but I find it really helpful when you read the documentation for functions. So I do read the documentation for functions. So you know, let's say you have Reshape and you're either Reshape wide or Reshape long, and then you've got some variable list and I and J, this is in Stata. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, you can just tune out here. I is going to be the ID variables for whatever you're reshaping on. And J is like either an existing variable if you're going from long to wide, or it's going to be a new variable you're creating if you're going from wide to long. So a thing that happens all the time is in your variable names, you might have like state underscore income. So it might be like AK underscore income, AL underscore income, right? Like some pattern where there's like a string, or it could be the other way, income underscore AK. Income underscore AL. So where that identifier that you want to pull out, that's the state name versus the variable name, could be different depending on how your data are structured. Or if you're, you know, that's going from wide to long, if you're going from long to wide, you might want to structure it differently. So I think often people come up with clever arrays and for loops and stuff to fix this, but state has got a built-in thing that can make this a lot easier for you. The at symbol, like the thing that's in your email address, like, you know, at indiana.idu, .edu. You just put that in the spot where this particular pattern is going to occur, and it'll tell you where the J component, that signifies where the J component is in the variable, in the pattern. So if you have like at underscore income or income underscore at in the reshape wide thing, that'll tell Stata what pattern is you're working on, and it can make your life a lot easier.
Wow.
So you're not going to have to rename
it. I did not know that.
That's cool.
I'm going to try it and give some reviews to the recommendation.
Yeah. I don't know if it's actually like necessary all the time. And the thing that, as I was saying this, is I'm not sure it could help you in the case where the thing's in the middle of a string, but yes. I'm not actually sure.
Because I always have to rename the things. Right. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
I haven't run into that particular issue in the wild, but I think that it would help in that situation.
Yeah, too. No, that makes sense. That's awesome. Thank you. And I also wanted to say that I picked up another recommendation of the week from our podcast a couple episodes ago, and I started watching Ted Lasso, and it's great. I mean, episode
3. Yes, got it. Thank you. Your life is better now.
Yeah. Anyways, okay. My recommendation of the week is actually a very simple one. I actually never done this, but I feel like it has a good recommendation and I want to do this, which is to schedule a very small, doesn't have to be a big deal, maybe weekend, maybe one day, maybe 2 day, mini vacation right after you're done with your classes duties. This is especially good at the end of the spring semester, but also can be great at the end of the fall semester. I think more of the end of the spring, so you can kind of separate your summer. I think it's good because sometimes when I finish classes, I have this like weird, it's like, okay, I'm done with classes. Okay, I guess I have to work back into research. And that transition always feels kind of weird. And I think as we learned in one episode, I think with Trevon Logan, that like transitions are important and marking those things are important. So maybe scheduling a mini vacation, like long time in advance, after you're done with your classes and everything, to signify this transition of like, you're done with this and you're going to start something new. Thank you so much for being here with us today. If people want to find more about you and your work, where should they go?
They can go to my Syracuse University website.
Awesome. We'll put it also on the show notes. That's all that we have for you folks today. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review. And thank you for tuning in.
Thank you.